happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries.
The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organisations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries.
EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries. The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoudeh Sabbagh, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad.
people filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop stores. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad and Syria. We'll continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us, no matter how much plots they hatch. We are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States.
It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The president of the UN General Assembly visited Pakistan. Volkan Buzgar met senior Pakistani authorities, including Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. His agenda includes regional and international issues, including Palestine, Kashmir, and the Afghan peace process. At a news conference, the president of the UN General Assembly made it clear no one can remain impartial in the face of Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Volkan said that political will shown by the General Assembly on Palestine must be used to force the UN Security Council for the resolution of this long-standing problem. During the 11-day Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, the United States blocked several attempts by other members in the UN Security Council to pass a resolution against Israel. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi briefed the UN General Assembly President about the current situation in the disputed Kashmir region. Kashmir remains a disputed territory between India and Pakistan since 1947. Both countries fought wars and held dialogue, but have so far failed to break the stalemate. Among other issues that came up for discussion during the visit of the UN General Assembly President include the current situation in Afghanistan. Both sides agreed there is no military solution to the Afghan war and that all sides must seize the current opportunity for a peace deal. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
To some, it's the most anti-Israel country in Europe. To others, the most pro-Palestine. Ireland, a nation of nearly 5 million and a member of the European Union. Days after a ceasefire ended 11 days of fighting set off by Israeli provocations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, Ireland has become the first EU member state to condemn Israeli settlement activity.
The Dáil has unanimously supported the Sinn Féin motion, which recognizes that Israel has illegally de facto annexed large portions of Palestinian land, which is totally illegal in international law. So this is a momentous decision.
The parliament made other decisions too. It stopped short of adopting an amendment from small left-wing party People Before Profit that called for the Israeli ambassador to Ireland to be expelled.
Although it's disappointing that we have seen that we haven't got the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador, we still have to focus on moving forward with other matters. But in saying that, there's absolutely no support for the Israeli ambassador being in Ireland within the general public. I mean, that's evident across all social media platforms.
The latest move is one of several by Ireland to support the Palestinian cause. The most recent examples, the 2017 hoisting of the Palestinian flag over Dublin City Council to mark 50 years of Israeli occupation, the funding of multiple developmental and humanitarian projects in Gaza, and the 2018 introduction of the Occupied Territories Bill. Still to become law, the bill hands down hefty fines or jail sentences to anyone found guilty of importing or selling goods originating from the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem al-Quds, or the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Slammed by Israel as an expression of full hostility, The bill and the latest condemnation are considered massive wins for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What has helped foster Irish solidarity with the Palestinian cause? The country's own experience with British colonialism.
The Irish people's bloody struggle for independence from British rule has inspired an emotional connection with the Palestinian struggle, a connection that continues to inspire them to support the Palestinian cause and call for an end to the conflict through Palestinian self-determination. Said Huriza, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. and place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, it is not likely that any of the top brass of the Saudi Arabia at the start of their onslaught on Yemen thought that 6.5 years later they would still be fighting. And now it is the Yemeni military along with Ansar Allah fighters who are now attacking Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman announced that Yemen had initiated retaliatory attacks inside of Saudi Arabia on the King Khalid military base in Aser. Stay with us as we take a look at how the tables have turned on the Saudi regime.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia. That is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliation. Military attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guest to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Elijah Macnion, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto, and Zafar, how could the Saudis have miscalculated Yemen this much? I mean, they thought the war would not take more than a month or two. Your assessment?
Well, basically, the Saudi defense minister, who is now also the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, when he was first appointed, he was full of arrogance. He thought that the Saudi army, because it is equipped with a lot of weapons, would be able to wipe out any Yemeni resistance. But what he did not realize was, number one, that the Saudi army is not motivated. In fact, they are not really capable of fighting. Number two, they underestimated the Yemenis' resistance. The point is that the Yemenis are fighting for their land, for their honor, for their principle. What the Saudis are doing is they are the aggressors. They want to occupy somebody else's land, and they want to install a puppet regime in Yemen. Obviously, that is not acceptable to the Yemeni people. Secondly, the Saudis counted on a number of mercenaries. In fact, they approached a number of countries, including countries like Pakistan and Egypt and so on, hoping that they would send their armed forces to support the Saudis, and these countries refused. So the Saudis had to resort to mercenaries from South America, from Africa, from Sudan, etc. But naturally, even these mercenaries cannot continue to wage a war on behalf of the Saudis. So as you mentioned, it's been more than 6 years, and I think the Saudi army and their soldiers, etc., have realized that this is a lost cause, and the best thing is not to put up a fight, and in fact, many of them are surrendering.
Well, Elijah, the Saudis initiated a ruthless onslaught on Yemen back in 2015, bombing civilian areas and infrastructure, and also implementing a land, air, and sea siege of the area. I mean, what was Riyadh really trying to accomplish with this type of violence against the civilian population in Yemen?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
There are 2 points. First of all, Saudis are trying to submit Yemen to its control because Yemen is considered its backyard. And secondly, they are afraid of the influence of Iran in Yemen. This is what the Saudis tried, started the war, thinking that it is a promenade, and thinking that in a matter of weeks this will end. It has been 6 years, and during these 6 years, the Yemeni learned how to make their own bombs, have learned the art of war, and they have also learned how to retaliate. And what we have seen very recently in the last 24 hours, how the Yemeni are taking the initiative and attacking Jizan and making really strong progress. Now, what Saudi Arabia is doing is really destroying Yemen. The cost of war so far is estimated around $100 billion. And the only thing that Saudis have achieved so far is the destruction of the country where there is the largest humanitarian crisis ever against the poorest country in the Middle East. We saw the Yemenis are learning how to fight back, how to make missiles, and how to do their own drones and armed drones and how to retaliate and hurt Saudi Arabia. And I think now the Saudis are trying to find a way out, but they want to gain in negotiation what they fail to gain in the war.
Okay.
Therefore, the Houthis... Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just get Zafar back in on this discussion. Well, although the Yemenis have been under a Saudi siege, Yemeni fighters and Houthis have continually improved, so much so that they are now attacking Saudi Arabia. What do you attribute this to? I mean, how are they able to do this despite the siege?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that the Yemenis are one people that has never, ever surrendered to foreign forces. That goes to their credit. Secondly, as your guest pointed out, the Yemenis have been able to make immense progress in terms of developing their military capabilities. Yemen already had actually a missile industry before the Saudis launched a war against them, but it was not as advanced as it has come now. And thirdly, the Saudi army, they're not only totally incompetent, they're also demoralized. So what the Yemenis have been able to do is, because of their determination, because of the fact that their cause is just, they are fighting to defend their own land. They're not committing aggression. In fact, even the operations that they are carrying out inside Saudi Arabia in provinces like Jizan and Asir, these actually belong to the Yemeni people. These were illegally occupied by the Saudis in 1934. So perhaps this Saudi aggression against Yemen that was launched in March of 2015 may turn out to be a blessing in disguise for the Yemenis, despite the enormous sacrifices that they have had to make, but that they perhaps might be able to reclaim the land that the Saudis had illegally occupied back in 1934. So their cause is just, they are highly motivated, they are excellent fighters, they have never surrendered to any foreign forces. All of these factors actually go in favor of the Yemeni people. Mm.
Okay. Well, Elijah, I mean, how significant in your perspective that we've seen the Yemeni forces just attacking a military base by drone inside of Saudi Arabia, and we've seen other retaliatory attacks and dealing with oil tankers. How disruptive has this been?
I think that had significant effect on Saudi Arabia economy, reputation, and finance. We saw how the Yemeni were able to disrupt the oil flow from Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world for several days and or even for a couple of weeks. And we saw how the Yemeni were able to head inland in Saudi Arabia and to give back the same amount of, not the same amount, but to retaliate in Saudi Arabia in different area, even going toward far in Saudi Arabia, so 1,200 kilometers. We saw how the Yemeni were capable to force the Saudis to the negotiation table. Unfortunately, the Americans are negotiating on behalf of the Saudis now in Sana'a and not the Saudis, because they don't have the skills or the courage to negotiate.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Elijah talked about the Americans negotiating on behalf of the Saudis. Your perspective on the United States, do you think that at this point in time that they want this war to end? Are you detecting some type of changing perspective coming out of Washington? Are your assessment overall?
Well, the Americans are actually trying to change the perception, but not their policy. So while Biden and his regime continues to talk about not providing offensive weapons to the Saudis, but we have seen no evidence that they have stopped supplying weapons to the Saudis or that they are still providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis. So these negotiations that are taking place under UN auspices regarding Yemen, obviously, as Elijah pointed out, these are basically guided by the Americans, because America virtually controls the United Nations, And so it is actually dictating the agenda. But what is important and crucial for your viewers to understand is that the Yemenis, throughout this war on them, have maintained the high moral ground. The Saudis have been attacking civilian infrastructure. The Yemeni Ansarullah fighters have not attacked any civilian infrastructures. They have targeted military installations. They have targeted economic installations. There was only one instance, in fact, when the Yemenis fired a missile at a palace in which they thought the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was staying. So throughout these 6+ years, the Yemenis have only targeted military installations because they do not believe in inflicting civilian casualties, although they can. So on these counts, I think the Yemenis really maintain the high moral ground, and they are fully justified in not accepting any demands that the Americans make of them.
Well, Elijah, what about Riyadh itself? Do you think it is looking for a way to end this war now?
Riyadh is really willing to come out of this problem that Saudi Arabia put itself in, and we cannot exclude the meeting, the couple of meetings that happened between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad, where the Saudis, on the top of their agenda, was the situation in Yemen. And we saw how Minister Zarif went to Muscat, Salam, to slow down on the base that the Saudis will lift the siege. And the Yemeni made it very clear, we cannot stop the war on our side because the Houthis are now dictating the battle. They said, we cannot stop the war on our side unless you lift the siege, and we will not accept an exchange of ceasefire in exchange of humanitarian aid. You allow us to survive, you allow us to live. We want the 16 ships that are full of oil. There is no oil in Yemen today, and we want all the aids before we start talking about a ceasefire. Today, Saudi Arabia is trembling of the idea that the Houthis are going to liberate Marib, and this is going to happen very soon. And I think they will liberate Marib and get their oil rich before accepting a ceasefire.
Okay. Well, Zafar, there seems to be a unique strength and determination in the Yemeni people. I mean, what is it that makes them so determined, although the Saudi regime is killing civilians on a regular basis, as well as destroying the infrastructure, restricting basic necessities, and at least 16 million Yemenis are estimated to be food insecure out of a population of 29 million, and they have refused to surrender to the Saudi regime. And you touched on this a bit, but I'd like for you to expand on it.
Sure. Basically, as I mentioned, the Yemeni people are absolutely brilliant fighters. There are very few other people in the world, perhaps I might even mention the Afghans, who have defeated now the third superpower of their time. But the Yemenis are absolutely determined fighters. But what is also very crucial to keep in mind is that the Yemenis don't rely only on weapons, they rely on their faith. They have a firm conviction in God's help. They are very, very determined people. They are very pious people. As I mentioned, they have not targeted civilians in Saudi Arabia, although they are quite capable of doing it, which shows that they have maintained the high moral ground. They have maintained their dignity and their honor in the face of all of these extremely difficult conditions that have been imposed upon them. I mean, you know, a country that is under total siege, they cannot get food in, they cannot get oil in, and, you know, millions of people are starving. More than 1 million children are afflicted by cholera epidemic. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of in recent history. And yet, the Yemenis have maintained their dignity and honor because they have such strong commitment to Allah and to Islam, mm-hmm. and they want to maintain that, and that is the reason why they have been successful. And I think we should take heart from this fact that whenever Muslims, regardless of where they are, for instance, you can look at the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, again, the commitment of the people of Palestine and their firm commitment to Allah has provided them these opportunities. So I think this is a very important lesson for Muslims worldwide,
okay.
that instead of relying on weapons, they can rely on the help of Allah and remain steadfast.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You heard Zafar, he talked about Palestine. I want to look at this because something else unique about the Yemenis, at the despite all of the hardships that we've just mentioned, some of them, they've recently been raising money for the Palestinians after the situation that took place, 11 days Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They have been busy raising money and giving support to the Palestinian cause despite them being under such pressure. Now, both of these groups, it's interesting, if we look at the similarities of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Yemen, both under siege, and the resistance despite this pressure both being effective. Your take on this?
This is a very important question. Apart from the touching move of the Yemeni, who are really starving and have very little asset, they managed to put together over $200,000. I mean, look at the amount they managed to put together to send it to Gaza and to support the Palestinian population. This gest is very significant, but the most significant, we see how the axis of the resistance that goes from Yemen to Tehran, to Baghdad, to Syria, Damascus, and to Lebanon, and to end in Gaza, how it is all compact and it's holding together. When Yemen came out and said, we are waiting for Gaza to tell us if they need us to fight and to support them, this is extremely significant, because that is the work of all these years, to bring out a line of population ready to fight against the aggressor, whoever they are, wherever they are, whoever they are, because even if they are very strong, the people of Yemen express their solidarity with Gaza to tell them that you are not alone and this whole front is here to support you. The creation of this front is the most significant issue in all of this.
Zafar, your take on this resistance front and being in solidarity now, of course, had been before, but definitely seeming to be even more effective than it has been. Your assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, as we see these developments unfold, the resistance front is gaining more and more strength. And this clearly indicates that the resistance front, which obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran is a major component of, has been motivated to a level whereby these resistance fighters are not guided by any worldly considerations, but in fact they are determined to uphold truth and justice, whether it is in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the rest of Palestine, in Iraq, where they are facing this American occupation, or in Syria, which again is has been subjected to this horrendous mercenary onslaught from all over the world, and of course with the American forces over there. But the fact that the Islamic Republic was upfront in supporting Syria, because Syria is a very, very important component for the resistance front in order to be able to provide material support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as material support to the people of Gaza. So we see that the resistance front is actually operating on very high moral principles and upholding justice and fairness. And I think any people that stand up for truth and justice and show solidarity, I think ultimately they will triumph.
And Elijah, your take, now that not only the resistance front, but we look at Yemen itself, the military and Ansar Allah, the Houthis are getting stronger by the day. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel as far as this war? Do you think that we're heading towards the end of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen?
Actually, I do, because today we see the axis of the resistance coming together, but we also see another element wherever there is an attack against one member of the axis of the resistance. The operational theater can be anywhere in these countries, and we're talking about Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. And this solidarity is forcing the other side, who is fighting in these countries, particularly the United States, to stop this war, to try to do something to stop this solidarity that is already made, and nothing can stop it. Therefore, I think the Saudis are really seriously going toward the ceasefire because they have lost the battle and they want to end it, come out with the less damage possible. Therefore, the negotiation that is happening in Muscat today, the Americans are trying to gain some ground, and the Houthis are very firm and they will continue to do so. And I think it is an advantage of the Saudis and the American to end this war, and I think this is going to happen most probably this year.
All right, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Zafar Bankash, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and Elijah McNear, journalists and political analysts out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
have placed the fountain in a corner of my living room. The sound of water makes me calm. Tomorrow, I'm going to take a trip to Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province to Lordegan County. I'm going to take you to one of the most beautiful waterfalls of Iran, to Atashgah Waterfall. Atashgah Waterfall is located in the proximity of Kherson River in Lordegan County in Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province. This waterfall is situated in a 3 kilometers long valley. Atashgah Waterfall is the longest waterfall of Iran. This waterfall originates from Dena Mountains in the central Zagros Mountains in south of Isfahan and north of Kohgiluye and Boyrahmad. The route of the waterfall from the spring to Kherson River is surrounded by a green environment with a species of trees and forest plants. The steep slope and ups and downs of this region has made multiple small waterfalls on the 3 kilometer way. I am now on my way to Atashgah Waterfall. On my right side, there is a picturesque valley which is very natural and a kind of untouched. In the middle of the valley flows a roaring creek. Do you hear the sound? Oh, well, this sound is not similar to that of my little fountain at home, yet it's as much relaxing. This region has an average to warm weather. However, inside the valley, the weather is so cool and pleasant. This is Atashgah Waterfall. Very beautiful. Around the waterfall, there are limestone and chalky rocks, and believe me, it looks like my little fountain at home. This waterfall is surrounded by old walnut trees, plane trees, oak trees, and ash trees. And I'd like to sit beneath this old plane tree and listen to the sound of Atashgah Waterfall. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Good morning.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.